Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, award-winning writer and scholar Eve L. Ewing discusses her new book, Original Sins, The Miseducation of Black and Native Children and the Construction of American Racism. She is interviewed by AWM President Kerry Cranston. This program originally took place February 10th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I was going to jump first to the idea that the last time I interviewed you for a book was 1919.
Yeah.
At Printer's Row, and obviously 1919 wrote the work and research you did for Ghosts in the Schoolyard. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of curious how the origin of this book is tied to some of that work and the work that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much. And first of all, I feel like I jumped right into reading. I didn't say a proper thank you for having me. I'm really grateful. So this book took the longest of any of the books that I've written. So I've been writing it, like opening a Word document for 5 years. But I started kind of writing it in my head and in my work about 10 years ago. So I've been teaching some variation of college, university courses on race and schooling for a decade. And I taught one at Harvard, and then I taught one at Wellesley, and then when I came back here, I co-taught with Dave Stovall at Stateville Correctional Center. So I've just taught versions of this a lot. Now I teach the same class to undergrads at UChicago. And I really felt, in a lot of courses about schooling and histories of schooling, it's about school, but like a lot of things in the United States, things that claim to be about everyone are actually just about white people's experiences. And so they would be about the history of schooling, but it would really be about like schooling for white kids. And then there might be like a chapter or a footnote or a little sidebar or a week in the syllabus that was like, and also all these other people had a totally different experience. And I felt that actually you didn't understand, I feel certain in the present tense, I feel that you can't really understand the way that American schooling works without understanding what school has meant for indigenous people in this country and what school has meant for black people. And that is like the story, that's like the main story as far as I'm concerned. And furthermore, that you can't really understand racism in the United States without understanding schools. And so in teaching these classes, I got to a point where I would begin the first couple weeks of class by talking about these histories. And on the syllabus, it would literally be called Original Sins, like Original Sins Week 1, Original Sins Week 2. Mm-hmm. And every year I was kind of like pulling together, okay, we'll read an excerpt of this, and then we'll read some of this and a little bit of this. And I was like, man, it would be really great if one book knitted this conversation together. And every year I would ask colleagues, like, hey, is there, something to read? And eventually I said I should just write it. So that's where we are. But the thing is that the claim is, like, kind of audacious, right? Because, when I wrote Ghosts in the Schoolyard, which is my last, like, book, like, nonfiction work, Ghosts in the Schoolyard in a lot of ways is, like, I felt that everybody knew. It was common sense. It was, like, community common sense. That part of why that the school closings were racist, like everybody knew that, and then also that there was this intimate relationship between public schools and housing and the history of public housing and the plan for transformation. Like people kind of knew that. A lot of y'all probably knew that. But I was like, I need to write a book that explains it step by step by step. And so, in a sense, that was like it wasn't easy, but it was a less audacious claim. And with this book, I'm like, schools are racist, and the project of schooling as it has come to exist in this country is racist, and also that schools are not just like, it's not just that America is racist and schools are here, yeah. It's that they're actually playing an integral role, and I call them kind of like a laboratory for perfecting and normalizing the technology of racist hierarchy. And that's a big thing to say. And so I felt like I really had to have a lot of receipts. I had to have a lot of evidence. And I didn't want it to be a polemical book. Not that there's anything wrong with like just saying things and believing them, but I felt like I need this to be like incontrovertible. That's why it's 400 pages. And the first version was much longer. My amazing editor, Elizabeth Mendez-Berry, who's in the audience, was like, we can't read 200 pages about Thomas Jefferson. Like, nobody, nobody. And, you know, they tell readers to kill your darlings, and I think I'm pretty good at that, but I held on for so long to so much Jefferson. And then I eventually just one day opened my eyes, and I was like, oh my, dude, the whole, like, first third of this book is about Thomas Jefferson. It's actually just misleading. It's just unfair to the readers. It's misleading. So, anyway, that's kind of where the book came from, and I feel really, really grateful because it feels like I've had a lot of time to work out the ideas in a way that is different from my other books, and I feel very grateful to, you know, every student I've ever had who asked a question or made a connection or, you know, things that helped me kind of workshop. You know, as a poet, those of us who come from a performance tradition, we often, you know, read the work and perform the work before we publish it, and I feel like I got to do some reps with these ideas too.
Awesome. You made me think of a different question than what I was going to
start with,
which is, you know, if you were working on this, one of the things that's really interesting about this, and you mentioned you are a poet, you write all these different types of ways and you're performative, you really balance in this book, and for anybody, you know, I'm sure that there are a lot of educators in the room, and there are maybe a lot of researchers in the room, and there is definitely a feeling in the book that this is for them. But it is not only for them. And you bring a lot of personal connection to from your history as a teacher, from yourself being a student. How did you think about balancing those things? Because it does not read like an academic book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, part of what I have always hoped to do is to sneakily change people's ideas about what an academic book can be. Because I'm an academic and I wrote the book, and so.
Yes. And the footnotes are very long.
Yeah. Yes. And so I think one thing to quote, you know, Nate Marshall, who you mentioned that is, you know, a close collaborator and friend of mine. And if you've ever heard me speak before, you've probably heard me quote this before. But something he said, like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something to me, he said, "The greatest thing a poem or a poet can give is permission." And so I think that, you know, when we choose to write in the way that feels the most in service of telling the story that we're trying to tell, then it gives people permission, gives writers, I hope, permission to feel like, oh, okay, that's like a thing that you can do. But really, I really value clarity, and I really want people to be able to use books. And so I think about, and in this case, I thought a lot about the people that I hope can use this book. And I try to revise with a really close eye to their needs. And I think often about specific people, like what would this person, what would this student, what would this colleague, what would my mom, like what would different people say if they read this? Would it be clear? Would it not be clear? And, you know, again, when you teach undergrads, you know, they'll make it very clear, oh, this book was so great, and I laid it out so clearly, and I really follow it, and then it's really clear when they, like, didn't read it, and it's not because they didn't want to, it's because they got tripped up, you know, at least for my students. They always want to read, they just sometimes. And so, you know, I think the personal elements, honestly, there are some early readers of the book that were like, we want more of you, we want more of you, and I think, you know, maybe some people will feel that way. But I really, number one, I'm a little private. And number two, I really didn't want it to be primarily memoir. And so I kind of pick and choose where I enter the text, you know, as a character. But I think I think my voice is there. I think it's clearly me talking.
And you talk about it, you know, the story, you know, there is a story here and it is an argument at the same time and it is audacious, as you said. So, and just some of the things, I mean, I've got a laundry list here, we won't get to them all. So I'm going to jump to, because you mentioned it, Jefferson and the Doctrine of Discovery.
Oh, great, yeah.
Because you obviously want to talk about it, and I think that it's something that people should recognize and understand, you know, beyond the, I think people know very much Jefferson as the slave owner and the hypocrisy and all of those issues. But when you really get into this Doctrine of Discovery and it, you know, reaches throughout the course of the book, so I'm kind of curious.
Sure.
To talk about it.
Yeah, well, so the reason I start off talking about Jefferson, and it's not that much, don't be, at the very last minute, I snipped a lot of it away. But the reason I start off talking about Jefferson is because I think that he, part of what this book is interested in is like what we think it means to be smart and what we think intelligence is. And what and a lot of that, I argue, like shapes things that happen in schools in ways that we don't really interrogate very often. And so one of the arguments I make is that Jefferson himself was an architect of some of that thinking, and also the ongoing canonization of Jefferson itself is a reflection of what we think intelligence is, right? So people still have these like Jeffersonian dinners, and I'm just like, which is just, it means like erudite salons or something, you know? And I like, they could be Du Boisian dinners, you know, they could be like, I don't know, other people, it could just be like dinners also. And I think that those are the kinds of things that represent that he was, you know, he was the sage of Monticello. He was this person who represented kind of like the thinking man's president. And so anyway, but also the Notes on the State of Virginia is this text where he talks about, you know, what he thinks of black people, what he thinks of native people, but also what schools should do. So I argue, and I'm happy to be wrong if somebody comes up with a different example, but I'm like, I think this is one of the first texts that is about race and education that's like written in the United States. But the doctrine of the of discovery was basically the idea put forth and legitimized by Jefferson and his contemporaries that allowed, that like made a legal claim for why the United States could seize land from indigenous peoples. And if you notice, it's you know, European colonial powers, imperial powers, they weren't landing on, you know, Spain wasn't landing in England and being like, no, we now plant the flag and this is Spain, right? And there's a specific set of presumptions that you have about the people in a place, right? The idea that in the Australian colonial context is called terra nullius, the idea that this is empty land. There's nobody here, right? It's open for the taking. And in order to believe that, you have to believe that the people that you plainly see with your eyes are nobody, right? That they are not humans, that they're not people. And so this is a kind of doctrinal move, like a legal axiomatic move that Jefferson uses to establish, to legitimize why is it that we can just see whatever land we want and take it when there are clearly people here, when that is not a way that European powers would treat one another. And I argue that basic idea of disappearance, right, that in order for this country to exist, that there has to be the myth that Native people have disappeared and were always destined to disappear, right? Even if you feel like sad about it, and there are times that Jefferson and others are like, oh, it's so sad, it's such a tragedy, right? But it's just destiny, it was just meant to be. And there are so many ways in which that persists into our curriculum, into the way we think about and talk about Native people, or don't think about and talk about Native people, right? And you know, even little examples in schools, things like, I don't know how many of you did, like whenever you talk about Native people in school, it's often in the past tense, right? Like the Natives did this, the Native Americans did this, right, in the past. And so there's this kind of like, you know, I've had people who told me, I didn't know that there were still Native people in the place that I lived, right? Even things like in statistics, you know, you'll see a bunch of racial statistics in education. There's a book about this called Beyond the Asterisk, where you'll see, you know, here's the statistics for black people and white people and Latinx people and Asian people, and there's an asterisk for Native people, right? That where there's not enough data. Well, there's not enough data if you set a certain type of statistical parameter that you don't have to set, right? And so there are all these ways in which the kind of everyday colonial function of the country is predicated upon the lie that, you know, that genocide was inevitable and divinely ordained. So that's, and that I would say comes from, not only, but comes partially from the doctrine of discovery.
Yeah. And when you move from Jefferson and you're kind of, as you said, it's kind of that early text about education with the notes, and I'm kind of curious, you bring up a concept that goes throughout the book, but it comes up early there, which is the difference between schooling and education. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure, and this is not my unique intervention. No. I mean, you know, many people, my mentor, Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, is somebody who I think I first heard this idea from. Dave Stovall talks about it a lot, but basically, education is everywhere. It happens all over the world and has always happened since the beginning of human existence, right? And I'm smiling because, like, just thinking about it makes me happy, you know? And it's teaching and learning, and that is, like, a beautiful, natural thing. And if I asked you, what is the most important thing you ever learned? Or tell me about a time when you remember learning, like, a valuable, memorable lesson. Many of you would not say anything about school, you'd be like, you know, one time I was on this fishing trip with my grandpa, and he taught me like how to tie a fly, you know, or one time, you know, my grandma taught me how to make mac and cheese the way she makes it, or, you know, one time I was with a coach and I fell down and I took it out on my teammate and they told me like that's not cool, right? Those things are all educational moments, and those things are beautiful and powerful and sustaining. And schooling is an institutional action, right, that takes place in an institutionally designated place that sometimes has to do with education and sometimes utterly inhibits education, right? Sometimes schooling undermines education. And so I think that that's an important distinction. And I know, like, I feel like especially I've been doing a lot of interviews for the book this week, and I feel a little like semantically annoying. And it almost reminds me of people within abolition spaces, you know, we talk about not just police, but like policing, right, or the criminal legal system. And so I think that's an important move to say, like, it's actually not just about these people, it's about a set of systems. And so similarly, I want to make clear when I'm talking about schooling and systems of schooling, that there's like a tripartite Venn diagram where there's schools, there's schooling, and there's education. And sometimes those things overlap and sometimes they don't.
And
I explained it very concisely.
Yeah. No, I think it's a very good point because it really opens up the ability to examine the historical context of schooling in the book as you're looking at these different elements. Because as you mentioned, the purpose of schools is one of the things that you are asking about
right
here, and it's something that shifts from time to time. Which we think of learning and education as what we're describing, but in truth, schooling is something that shifts for different audiences.
Yeah.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it shifts for different audiences and at different historic and political and economic moments in our society, right? So I begin this section by talking about Sputnik, which, you know, maybe some of you in the room can talk about. You know? But, you know, so when Sputnik, you know, Sputnik first launches and it's seen as this, like, crisis in the United States, right? We're losing the space race. And for those that are familiar, it's a satellite that the USSR, former USSR, launched into space. And so it was like, oh no, the Russians are beating us, the Soviets are beating us in the space race. And there was all this kind of hand-wringing and analysis and kind of congressional investigation. And they decided that, you know, it wasn't the military's fault, and it wasn't, why are we losing the space race? It's not the military's fault, and it's not the scientists' fault, and it's not NASA's fault. It's schooling. Like, our schooling has failed, and we're not preparing enough people to be scientists and to, you know, do the things that they need to do. That today we would say something like, to thrive in a global society, globalizing world, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's all this funding that for the first time, and all these pushes of things that now we take for granted, like the expansion of STEM education and schools, right? That was for this specific purpose. And even like funding, for example, to study languages, but, you know, expanded for the first time in schools, but it couldn't be dead languages. It was only languages that would be, you know, so no Latin, no ancient Greek, no ancient Hebrew, right? Just things that would like help the US win the space race. And so, you know, that's one example that I use because I think from our vantage point, it's kind of like funny and illustrative. But, you know, we can think about even in, you know, from the 80s to the 90s and into the present, these different things that happen in school that are by no means self-evident, right, but that were meant to serve a specific purpose. And one of the things I talk about is how over the course of the history of schools, that the purpose that schools are supposed to serve for white children versus for Native children versus for Black children are very different. And part of what I read in that passage is even some of the origins of this going back to the 19th century. And, you know, I really like reading those Lydia Child textbook passages. Number one, because like I said, I'm really trying to like marshal a lot of evidence to make my points here. But to say in a textbook, like the most important thing you can do is to never be mad at the person who enslaved you. That is the most important thing, right? And even teaching about history, teaching about, you know, people like John Brown or Toussaint Louverture, that we might say these are important, figuring out a way to teach about them that serves these very specific, you know, social ends, which was to make sure that formerly enslaved people, who in many places far outnumbered their enslavers, did not rise up, right, and revolt. And to say like, oh, okay, you might look at Haiti over there, but you don't want to do that. And we're going to tell you why. And actually, if you do that, people in Brazil are still going to be in slavery, and it's going to be your fault, right? And so that's a textbook. And so I think, you know, that kind of specific, the idea that the most important thing here is for you to learn subservience and to learn your place is something that I talk about extensively. And then for native kids, really this idea of disappearance through assimilation, right? And also, I would have kept reading, but I felt like I was going long, but the actual in text, on paper, out loud, people like Carl Schurz and Merrill Edwards Gates, who were overseeing Native education at the time, saying things like, it is cheaper for us to win the quote-unquote Indian War with teachers. That is less expensive, right? And Carl Schurz, who was the head of the Secretary of the Interior, he specifically said, like, it costs this much money per soldier and it costs this much money per teacher. And Richard Henry Pratt, who I mentioned briefly, who was the founder of Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which is the first of these residential boarding schools, he said, you know, I'm fighting a war with an army of teachers. And so this was very specific, the idea of, you know, taking kids, kidnapping children, and making sure that they could not speak their language, that they were separated from their families, and that all that was native within them died, as they put it. And I think thankfully many people are coming to be more and more aware of this history, but it's also important to know that, like, those kids were also being kidnapped as leverage to control their parents back home. Right, the idea that your kids have been taken away and you need to be compliant and you need to not rise up and resist and you need to be complicit in your own disappearance or else you're not going to get your kids back, right? These people have your children and you don't know where they are.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, the Pratt thing was something that you mentioned, you know, sometimes you ask your students and they don't know who he is. He's not somebody that we're taught about in school or anything like that. The only reason that I knew who Pratt was before reading your book was only because I just read Tommy Orange's second novel, which Pratt is a character.
Yeah.
And but you know, I mean.
And I will say, by the way, he wrote a really long memoir, so a lot of the things that I'm quoting are like from his memoir. Like he said, all these people said, "Hey, let me write down the most horrific things that I've done."
That's the hardest thing about the book is, you know, you just, as you said, brought the receipts. So many of these things are in print. You know, quotable, in perfectly there.
Yeah.
Including the educational materials that you often reference.
Yes.
That aren't just old. Some of them are things people could use today.
Right.
Like for a Columbus Day celebration.
Right.
You know, and I mean, talk about like something like that that you saw and what that ties into, you know.
Sure. I'm laughing because your version of the book, can I see,
sorry.
No, that's great. So the galley of the book, this is like insider only knowledge.
Oh, did it not make it?
Yeah, it didn't make it because we couldn't clear copyright. So
There's still a lot
about Columbus, but I'm laughing. Raise your hand if you're a teacher, any teachers in the room? Hey, okay, yes, shout out to you. So teachers, any like pre-K to 3 teachers, yay, early childhood books. Okay, so do you guys know like, do you use Teachers Pay Teachers? A few people, yes. Okay. So do you know what I would call on the worksheet, like the general worksheet that has like the Lemonhead characters? So like Lemonhead, Jefferson. Yeah, can you find this Lemonhead person?
Yeah.
So basically, like it's very common for kids in early education to learn about Columbus. And I actually did a study with one of my undergraduate colleagues. Yeah, okay, great. Oh, it's so small, so you can't see it. Darn. Okay. Well, basically, we have copies of these worksheets that we found. My research team and I found on Teachers Pay Teachers, and I work with an amazing undergraduate colleague, Maggie Rivera, as a student, former student of mine. And we did this analysis of something like 3,000 lesson plans on Teachers Pay Teachers, which, if you're not familiar with it, is exactly what it sounds like. It's an online marketplace where teachers can make and sell worksheets and things like that. And so we did analysis of the phrase Columbus Day, because I thought, okay, there's all this amazing critical discourse happening around Columbus Day now, and like maybe that's being reflected in what we're seeing on this website, and it is not. And so there are many, 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 many teachers still using and selling and making and distributing materials about Columbus in which he is, sometimes for older kids, represented as like a debate, right? Like Columbus, good or bad, let's discuss. That's like the more progressive end, but most of them are presenting him in a very positive light. And most often, he's presented in materials for kids that are like third grade or younger, little kids. And often with these kind of like cartoony, like smile, like the ovoid head with the smile that's just a line and then the two dots. If you've ever like a Sunday school teacher, and you know this, you know of which I speak. And, you know, it'll be activities like Columbus is going on a trip.
what would you pack if you were going on a trip? Make a list, right? You know, Columbus took a boat. You can make a boat out of paper, like put it in a bathtub. You know, these crowns, very popular, these the Columbus like explorer hat that you can cut out in color and make into a thing with the big Spanish cross on it. Sometimes there's also a Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, and they're also like a smiling, you know, and it's like, learn these words, queen, king. And so what fascinates me about these is that I find it really bizarre that we have decided as a culture that this is like somehow essential knowledge for very young children, that obviously is giving this, you know, extremely sanitized version of somebody that was deeply complicit in genocide and enslavement, and that that is very well documented. And I find it, and like none of these activities, they all have very little educational merit, and also like don't really teach about Columbus. So like, if you wanna do a, like, let's make a list of things to take on a trip, Bessie Coleman went on a trip. Your grandma's going on a trip. Like, lots of people go on trips, right? And so it's like, I sort of in the book, I compared Columbus to like Santa Claus. Like, we've just decided that he's almost a mythical character upon which we're projecting all this stuff for reasons that are unclear to me. And, you know, one might obviously say, well, you know, if we're going to teach about Columbus to really little kids, it's not appropriate, or it's not age appropriate to teach kids about like violent genocide. Now, we can have a discussion about that, because many of us, depending on your background, we don't have the privilege of waiting until you're much older to learn about how awful the country has been to you or your ancestors or people like you. But saying that, if we'll take that for the sake of argument, then like, don't teach about Columbus in kindergarten. Right? We don't teach about Pol Pot in kindergarten, right? We don't teach, there are lots of atrocities that we don't teach about until, you know, or we say, we're gonna teach this in an age-appropriate way, but we're gonna tell kids the truth, and then we're gonna kind of scaffold them into it as they get older. And so, I cite this as an example of the kind of very casual way in which we're asking kids to identify with this violent colonialist figure, right? And we're making it very clear to them, who is the hero in the story? Who are you? Who are you to project upon in this story, right? And so, yeah, I think that the kind of like the casualization of Columbus and his ubiquity is really shocking to me, because it's just kind of like a gimme. Like, it's just, you know, I mean, every year, of course, there's a few people, but like, it should be kind of an easy one at this point, and it's not. I also, there's the one thing we were able to, well, there are a lot of things, but one of the images we were able to keep in the book is these covers of different books that are about Lewis and Clark and Sacagawea, and they're all just like, every book cover is just Lewis and Clark standing on the cover being like, aha! Like, it's just them pointing towards Manifest Destiny, I guess. But there are all these like children's books about them, right? And so again, who are we canonizing? And I know this is becoming a long-winded answer, but I'll say one more thing, which is there's some really great research by a friend and colleague of mine, Harper Keenan, and some other scholars, that actually like looks at textbooks and analyzes the incidence of how often they talk about Native attacks against colonizers and settlers, European settlers, versus vice, you know, the inverse. And on average, textbooks would make it seem that there are lots and lots of Native people only attacking white European settlers, and that the inverse was not true. And that's just not represented in the historical record, right? And so again, what is the story that we are telling kids about who we are, who's the main character, and who is gone, right? Who we're only talking about as a relic of the past.
And so I'm kind of curious, thank you for that. And I think it's, again, the structure of this book is extremely well put together in making an argument, and at the same time bringing interesting characters, some good, some bad.
Yeah, a lot of bad.
But you because of how you're able to quote them and how you're able to bring them in, it's really interesting to see things. And so we can talk about the evils of standardized testing, and the things that are wrong with it. But you make it very human. You know, Terman
was Terman.
Bring him,
Carl Brigham. Yeah,
and you really bring these people to life who have had this profound impact.
Yeah.
I mean, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, it's important to understand that, you know, these are all elements of what you're talking about,
right,
and how these people have built a structure into our educational systems. But as individuals, these people have profound racist views.
Yes. Yes. So, yeah, I think, well, yes, that period. But, yeah, I guess I can talk to, I mean, one of the most astonishing quotes that I include in the book is that Carl Brigham, who was one of the, we could say, like, fathers of standardized testing and the SAT, you know, later in his life, he was like, I was so foolish to think that intelligence was something that we can capture in this way. And he says, I hope no one believes that now, right? Like, exact quote, I hope no one believes that now. It's like, no, people do, right? And I think about this, again, this is me being, like, probably kind of annoying, but I think about this a lot, even as it pertains to things like IQ, right? These terms that people still use very casually, right, as though they represent real things. And, you know, there's people say all the time, like, race is a social construction. And, you know, Dorothy Roberts, who's an amazing sociologist and legal scholar, talks about the fact that, like, even when people say that, sometimes what they mean is it is, like, a set of social frameworks used to describe a biological fact. Like, you still kind of believe somewhere deep down that there's something inherently biological about race. And I think that the same is true of IQ, and that I think that and I call this the gospel of intellectual inferiority, that I think that there are many, many ways in which, without realizing it, without examining it, that people have deeply internalized the idea that Black and Native children in particular are less intelligent. And there are all these structures that kind of reinforce that, but also that the very idea of what we describe as intelligence goes uninterrogated. And so, yeah, that's kind of, you know, thinking about those guys. And I think, there are a lot of specific examples of old standardized tests that I use, that I talk about in the book. So one of the, basically the first standardized tests in the United States is called the Army Alpha and Beta tests. And these were given to soldiers that were recruited in World War I. And, you know, they ask all these questions and they use it to say, like, oh, you know, these Black people are inherently less intelligent. And also these immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe are less intelligent, right? And then I quote some of the questions, and the questions are just so, like, culturally specific. It's like, you know, if you're hauling a wagon of coal and it got stuck in the mud, what would you do? You're like, I don't know. Right? And so there are all these examples of, if you're a recent immigrant or if you are a Black person raised in the agrarian South, you're just like, I just don't know what you're talking about. And even at the time, there were people who did these analyses who said, well, if this is predicting, if IQ is real and if Black people inherently have a lower IQ, then why is it that Black people from the North who've had more access to schooling are consistently scoring higher on these tests than Black people in the South who've been kept from going to school? And the answer by, you know, Terman and Brigham and others was, well, it's because all the smart ones went North, right? So it's a selection bias, that those are the ones that were industrious and went North, right? And so there's all these ways in which, you know, these things really get kind of normalized and reinforced without questioning, without asking about them.
And you make the connection between, you know, even though we're talking about things that started in World War One, I think Terman was involved in the testing into the 80s.
Yeah, until he died. Yeah, and so the official Stanford Binet, which is the, you know, kind of a gold standard IQ test. It's on, I think, the fifth or sixth edition, and what edition is out right now is the first or second one that did not have his direct involvement when he died. Also, one of their old logos, which I'm also pleased that we got into the book, is just like a globe with calipers over it. It's just like a, it's just like, we're measuring the brain of the world. It's pretty bad. And then another one of their old logos is a bell curve. That's also not great, yeah.
And but you also point out that, you know, there were some studies in more recent years that look at the testing that got these, especially when Black students did well.
Yeah, on the SAT. You're so good at these questions, Carrie. Yeah, so there's some recent analysis. So any of you who've taken the SAT in the last, like, 20 years know that there are norming questions on the SAT. So some of the high school teachers, okay, do you explain this to your students? Do you tell them about the norming questions? All right, interesting. So thank you for taking part in my survey. So the norming questions are basically like tests. They're being piloted. And so, you know, you want to, basically the idea is that if a question is, in theory, like the right amount of challenging, you want some people to be able to get it, you want some people to not get it, and you want a bunch of people to be in the middle. Now, that unto itself has like a whole bunch of design assumptions that, again, we will set aside for the moment. My husband teaches at a place where, like, no more than a certain percentage of students can get a B+. So it's, like, impossible for everybody to, anyway. I'm going to come back to that in a second. But so they have these norming questions, which are just basically like thrown on to the SAT every year to test and see how different groups do on them. And there are some scholars that have found evidence that on questions where Black students just happen to outperform white students for whatever happenstance reason, those questions get thrown out. And they get thrown out because the assumption is like, it must be a bad question, right? There must be something wrong with the question, and that is not true for white students. And so the test itself is a tautological exercise. And I think that that's really uncomfortable because we live in a country that likes to believe it's meritocratic. We like to believe that we've earned what we had, right? And our individualistic ideology about pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps is really threatening to people. So I'm an alum of Northside College Prep, and to get into Northside, especially at the time, this was like the selective enrollment testing has changed, but at the time, you know, a long time ago when I applied to get in, it was like there was this test. And it was sort of similar to these kinds of cognitive tests. Like, I remember one of the questions was, you know, if you fold up a piece of paper and then punch holes in it and unfold it, like, what will it look like? And things like that. And then you also just had to have certain grades, and that was the cutoff. And so you are selecting upon people's performance on test scores and grades for admission into the school. And then every year, the Sun-Times would be like, Northside Prep, number one school in the state. And people that I went to high school with would like repost it and be like, we're number one again. And I was like, you're selecting on the line, right? And so like, it's like if I had a track team and I was like, you can't be on my team unless you run a 6-minute mile. And then I was like, my team is the fastest team. It's like, sure, your team is fast, but you only picked, right? And so I say that, and when I used to say this, this was back when I was on the Facebook hellscape, right? This is like reason number 394 to get on Facebook. But it really upset people that I went to school with, right? Including people that were from like comparatively really struggling disadvantaged backgrounds, right? People that were like, that they said this, and what they said was true. Like, I worked hard, right? Like, this school meant a lot to me. Like, we did not have a lot of Black kids at our school, and it meant a lot to me, right? Like, and sure, and also, there's this is a selection effect, right? And so I think that is a challenge for some of these conversations about testing in school. If you are the type of person that is just like randomly good at school, is that it really can be, I think people take it as like an assault on something to do with their character, their personhood, or who they are. I will say, like, a lot of why I am where I am in my life is because of the random skill set that any of us get. Mine like sort of match up to the thing, to the also equally random set of things that are valorized and celebrated in schools. And so things that I happen to like happen to be the like good school things. And there are many, many other people in your lives and in my lives that are like creative and incredible and brilliant by whatever that means to you, where their skill set just doesn't match up with the school stuff. And I just think it's important for us to have that conversation and to be cautious of the ways that we very casually refer to those things as though it's real, as though it means something, you know.
And and I want to open it up to questions in a minute, but you know, there are sections of this. A lot of this book is very difficult.
To read or like to
emotionally.
No,
I'm sorry.
It's suitable for like a 10th grader.
Yes. Anybody can read it. It is a phenomenal book, and everybody should read it. What I'm saying is that
it's also available as an audiobook.
There are some points at which, and you even have kind of a little warning, and
yes.
There's a section on intellectual inferiority, discipline, and punishment,
yes.
Which can be very brutal and,
yes.
and hard to think about, and also just, you know, the quotes, the things that are in here. And what you're looking at is a system that is very difficult to deal with. So in the end of the book, you're trying to provide a certain amount of idea of,
yeah.
of solace and movement forward,
sure.
or change. Some of it very radical in the notion. And I just thought I'd ask you, as a way of ending this conversation
yeah,
and opening
you.
It up, to talk about the idea of grading.
Oh yeah, thank you so much. So, you know, I was trying to think about how to close the book, And I really, so this book, it was very important to me that it not be like a prescriptive checklisty book. Like, I didn't want this to be a book where like you pay me money and I give you a workshop and you like check off all the things and you're like, I got a certificate and now my school is better, right? Where actually, if you believe that these things are deeply endemic, then our work has to be to pull them up by the roots, you know? And so, but that being said, I do think it's important, not just like for reader satisfaction, but also politically, to think about, you know, how we move. I wouldn't even say forward because it's too much of a linear time for me, but like how we move together. And so, you know, in thinking about this, I was really thinking, searching for metaphor, right? And I think that sometimes metaphor is important to me because it helps us remember the heart of something. It helps us capture what it is that we're really trying to get at. And I arrived at the metaphor of braiding partially because I saw in 2020 this amazing piece of art, and it was done by an indigenous woman who posted this art on Instagram, and I kind of quote her and cite it in the book. But it's basically a black woman and a native woman standing back to back, and their hair is braided, and it's braided together at the bottom. And, you know, this was at a time, 2020, right, in the kind of like fervor of talking about racial injustice and the death of the murder of George Floyd. And I felt so moved by that because, without boring everybody in this room, in the academy, in the areas of black studies and native studies, there's a history of people using this word of incommensurability, meaning like these two things will always be at odds because if one premise of black studies, depending on who you talk to, if one premise is that like anti-blackness and enslavement are the governing logic of all the world, and if part of one strand of thought in native studies is that like settler colonialism and the genocide of indigenous people is the 111 governing logic of the world, then they can never be reconciled. And so there are a lot of, you know, in academia, there's a drive towards competition. People get material resources from competing with each other and like dunking on each other. Yeah, and so like that to me from a political perspective is not how I like to move. Because I think we're all doomed if we do that, right? Like, I think solidarity, like being able to move in solidarity with people is important, not just because of my own like ethics or my feminist practice or whatever, but also because like we're in grave danger. And also because some of the stuff people are fighting about is like basic and trifling and like not that, like your citations are not, it's not that serious. And so, oh, it is if you have this mindset of like needing to protect your fiefdom. And I also think it's like very capitalist and white supremacist, which is the irony of all this. And so it was really, so that image really moved me. And as I was writing the book, I also really wanted to, as I was writing about these terrible things, be like enacting the practice of being together. And so my good friend and colleague, Amanda Ticini, who I quote extensively in the book, we co-organized this conference called Cultivating Black and Native Futures in Education. And it was online, and we had like hundreds of people from all over the world, and we had amazing sessions. And so I just was looking for the right metaphor to think of like that work of coming together. And I landed on braiding because I love it, and because there's something about braiding that requires a tenderness. And I am, you know, I'm a black feminist. I don't just mean that I'm a feminist who is black, but I mean that I work within the tradition of black feminism. And as I read and learn and study and hear and listen more about understanding indigenous feminisms, I think this idea of care work is a place where these schools of thought and praxis come together. And the idea that like the first thing you do is just try to take care of people, which I think it not incidentally is like the antithesis of the kind of schooling that I'm writing about here. And that, you know, I remember my first year as a teacher, and there were so many things that I like did wrong and messed up. And I remember my mom saying like, if you just love people, that actually goes a lot farther than you might think, right? And all these kind of like technocratic things. And, you know, and my students would say the same things to me all the time. Well, Missy, you know, we know you love us. We know you love us, right? And, you know, sometimes, I remember once a student told me, like, sometimes when I'm having a bad day, I just know I'm going to see Miss Ewing, and she just loves me, right? And, like, that's just, I could, like, you know, I mean, you don't want to be, like, professionally negligent. I care about being a good teacher. But that does count. And so grading is something that requires love. It requires intimacy. It requires tenderness. It requires care. It requires time. And, you know, that I don't just mean braiding of hair. I also mean, like, braiding of stories. I mean knitting. I mean weaving. I mean braiding of cultures. I mean making challah and braiding, like, and all these things. And, of course, Robin Walkenberg's Braiding Sweetgrass, right? I was also reading at the time. So that's kind of where I landed. As you said, I appreciate that you used the word radical. I think that some of the things that I am suggesting towards the end of the book are pretty radical in what I hope is a good way. And I think, like, the really what I'm hoping people will do is use this as a conversation to think about, like, where you begin. Like, you, your people, your collective, your community, your school, you know, the people that you love and care about and feel tenderly towards. But I hope you do that with that attention towards care. So that's why braiding.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is wonderful. As I mentioned, the book is amazing.
Thank you.
I think that everybody should and can read it. And I think that the radical ideas that you bring up and this notion are not that far a field when you have gone through the historical context and understood some of the problems that are inherent in the schooling and how it has been built.
Thank you.
I think it's a wonderful argument.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Extremely well written. So
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.